Hello and welcome back, everybody. I'm Dan John, and this is the podcast for danjohnuniversity.com. This is episode 145, and each and every time I start this, I'm always a little surprised how many we've done, and really the responses we're getting now. It's becoming very popular. A lot of people have told me it's their go-to podcast. I've been told that this is the podcast people listen to on their walks. So if you're out there exercising right now, I'm walking with you, and I really appreciate that. I think that's wonderful. Keep on walking, and there's nothing but good value to it. This week, we've got some good questions. Oh, a reminder, remember now, the goals course has expanded in size. I almost forgot. So we've doubled the amount of information there with a whole bunch of new stuff I've been working on. If you're already a member of the site and you already purchased it, it's just more. So go ahead. It's all free for you for the new stuff. And if you're not a member, why aren't you a member? Join danjohnuniversity.com. Use the code GOALS, G-O-A-L-S, and that'll get you a big discount on joining the site. And then from then on, just go to the courses, try the workout generator, the tons and tons and tons of pages of free materials and all the books that are on the PDF site. There's a lot of information. And then pop in the forum. The forum is really good. We have a great conversation this week from a eighth grade basketball coach that I think is, I mean, it is should be in a coaching book. All right, well, let's get started. Our first question is from Jeff. And Jeff says, during podcast number 140, you were counseling a former Marine and recommended him to doing a goblet squat at the end of each set of 15 swings. Other than adding more work, is there some kind of benefit from doing this? I have re-listened that segment a couple of times, but I didn't hear any explanation as to why. At almost 59 years, 2 weeks away, I'm up for anything that will improve performance and or avoid reduce risk of injury. Boy, that's a good question. And it was one of those things, Jeff. If you asked me this question like once a week for like a year, I think I'd give you 52 good answers a year. The first is that when people are doing swings, I like them to make sure they have nothing but control as they go to those last reps. So doing that last rep, we have to do that. We call it a two-hand clean. I got this from Mike, the term from Mike Krifka. On that last swing, you have to slow your tempo down, pop it up, and now you're controlling the bell. And that's really important, I think. I think it's really important when you do ballistic work that you are in control of everything. So that, okay, so like number one is it ensures that you finish with appropriate tempo, appropriate hit, and still have control. Number two ties right in. So the swing is maximal hip bend and appropriate knee bend. And the squat is maximal hip bend and maximal knee bend. So they're on opposite ends of what I call the hip displacement continuum. And once again, if you ever use that phrase, remember, it's not displacement. It's when my dog Lexi died, she had dysplasia. And so hip displacement became a kind of an N-word in our coaching staff. It's not really a joke, but that's how it. And so if you ever see someone talk about the hip displacement continuum and not reference my dog Lexi, you know they're just stealing the work offline and pretending that there's theirs. But so what's nice about going swing and any goblet squats after is I think it reminds the person of this is a swing, a hinge, and that is a squat. The next one is what you'll notice when you do a lot of kettlebell swings is that the ab wall goes, for every time you go boom, the ab wall bites down and counters the weight. Boom, boom. And if done correctly, the ab wall becomes part of that whole chain to stop the kettlebell from, you know, flying away. And I like my athletes to do a vertical plank, pull down and throw it back. So when you do 15 swings, you know, you've lit up the ab wall 15 times in that kind of sneeze position. When you do the goblet squat, you do what I call anaconda strength. You build up that inner tube of your body, and you tighten and brace everything as you go up and down. So what's nice about that is your hips, your ab wall, and I mean, you can just keep running with it, your spinal erectors and everything else. You're giving them two sides of the training. The other reason I really like, and you'll notice a lot of my workouts go swing, goblet squat, and then either a push-up position plank or a push-up. I mean, a lot of my workouts have that three-part. The most famous is a humane burpee, but there's many other variations. Is what we're doing in that is we're changing levels just a little bit. Like I said, levels, the floor is a level. My chair here is I'm at a level. Standing's a level. Now, obviously, when you swing and you goblet squat, you're standing from both of them. But in the way I look at it, you're doing two different movements. Now, if I should have said, always do a set of 15, follow it with a goblet squat, and then get on the floor and get back up somehow, because I think that is just as valuable to what we're trying to do. And you'll notice if you have a heart rate monitor, that the heart rate goes up when you get up and down off the ground, which is, I think, just fascinating. So there you go. I mean, that's a pretty basic review, but that's how I see things. And like I said, you know, Jeff, we'll be sitting down in a week or two and you'll say, well, I tried it and then I discovered this. And I'll be like, oh yeah, that. If all you did was swings, goblet squats, and either a press or a push-up, you'd be okay. That's a pretty good combination. Great question, Jeff. Way to kick off our week. We got a question from Chris. I'm a newly hired high school football coach. Our school has a very proud track program, and I want to urge my players to join up. Don't urge, insist, but I'll move on. Have you found a track season to be a good enough training amount for football players who aren't overall interested in track otherwise? Or do they need extra weight sessions as well? My football comrades seem to be pushing their athletes away from track. Well, but yeah, not the good schools. You know, I was with that Oklahoma coach a couple of years ago, and they actively look for shot putters and sprinters because, those BS combine numbers, you know, the kid runs a 4.2, which, you know, is physically impossible. But if you run 100 meters in 10.5, you are fast. And with fully automatic timing, everybody knows you're fast. You probably don't have to worry very much. This kid is going to be fast and remain fast. If you got a kid who throws a shot, you've got five offensive linemen who throw the shot 65 feet. Yeah, there's a real good chance you're going to be able to run the ball a lot that season. The measurement. See, the thing, you know why people hate track, Chris? I'll tell you why. It's we use tape measures and timers. Nobody wants that in now. You know, your parents want to spend extra money to send your kid to a clinic or a 7-on-7 league where they get specialized training. Send them to a personal trainer who will look at, they'll look at the tackle and say, see, when you tackle, it's a bicep curl. Yeah, that'll stop the opponent from running past you, bicep curling them. The problem with track and field, swimming, and a few other sports, weight, Olympic lifting, is that they're dying because they're measured sports. You know, if you're bragging about, Chris, you're bragging about your wide receivers long jumping 15 feet, you guys are terrible. You guys are awful. You know, your whole wide receiver core, your defensive backs, I'd love to see him hurdle and do the 4x1. Your wide receiver core, I would say the long jump, triple jump is phenomenal. Obviously sprints if appropriate. Your thrower types, you know, make great linebackers and strong safeties. Defensive ends, throwers, you could probably go through and line up. And I would also, if you take it seriously, now say 3 or 4 years from now, begin to put together the track numbers and slide them over to performance. You'll probably find the kids that, sprint 4 events in a track meet are probably going to be your best conditioned athletes. Support track as much as you can. Sadly, it's dying. And do real numbers, you know, go. I joke about this all the time. My high school track and field team at South City High have been state champions in most divisions most of the years I've been in Utah. There's only been a few years my high school throw 170 wouldn't have been state champion here or made state in almost every state. And yet, when I was growing up, that was fine, but it wasn't good. It just shocks me to say that now. Years ago, we had a kid, had an athlete win the state championship, and I literally threw 40 feet farther than him. So the beauty of track is that the numbers are lines in the sand. The downside is I can tell you whether or not you're good just by the number. So, yeah, support it. And also, I don't know why you're not wrestling. Okay, bye-bye. We got a question from Lewis. You've mentioned the broad jump several times, and I was wondering if you could give some guidance on how to train this movement in a progressive, systematic way. Well, it's a test, Lewis. Perhaps the answer is simply perform broad jumps, and if so, recommended time jump reps would be helpful. I'm 40 years old. I've been exercising with kettlebells for the past 6 months. 6'4", 200. Yeah, the only thing, Lewis, I use them as a test, the standing long jump as a test. So there is value in just doing standing long jumps. It is a kettlebell swing. I joke about this all the time. If you really want a good workout, do standing long jumps around a typical track, 400 meters, and just do, you know, four loops of that and call me when you finish the workout. If your question is more nuanced than that, you want more on jumping itself, why don't you just send me another question and I'll be happy to do it. When I work with track and field athletes in the jumps, it's interesting because first off, I try to find the simplest technique possible, which is interesting because it's the flop. Dick Fosbury, who invented it, his college coach at Oregon State did everything he could to stop Fosbury from doing that technique. And of course, after Fosbury became famous, that same coach went around the country teaching everybody how to do something he was radically against, which is always fascinating to me. Stop. But in the long jump, one of the skills we try to use is jumping for height in training. This is high school kids, so there's value to that. And in the high jump, there's an interesting little thing called the high jump for distance, which is interesting. I've stolen this, using this in other places, but somebody told me about this years ago. So if you have high school boys, you know, probably 4 feet. This is for my American audience, I apologize. You take about 4 feet, which what they can all jump, and you just leave the bar up there. And what you try to do is, you know, do kind of a long jump competition. You know, wherever they land is where they hit. And it really does teach them to come up to the bar in their J curve, but with a lot more speed. So there's some fun drills we could talk about, but this will be enough for now. It's a test. Practice it as you wish. Enjoy it. We have a question from Ben. I have recently switched over to the throws coaching. I'm in the UK and throws coaches seem few and far between. We are blessed to have one, but he is well-meaning curmudgeon, and there are times when his pedagogy is not great. The younger, less experienced pupils get discouraged and, in such a technical event, do not find themselves making the progress they want. Yeah, I've been at practices in the UK for track, and I can't imagine anything worse. They get in this line, 15, 20 throwers. They all step into the cage. They all stand in the front. They forgot what they were doing because they haven't thrown in 20 minutes. They take a throw. They stand in the ring while the coach reviews the throw. Then they go on the other side of the cage to wait until all the other throwers went. Then they all go out, get their discs, get back in line, and throw again. That'll get you about 5 throws an hour, and I like about 500 throws an hour. Go to danjohn.net and look up my free book, A Contrarian Approach to Discus Throw, and you'll see how I coach the throws. I do not have a throwing background, but I have a passion for the events, as well as for coaching and physical fitness. I would like to know how I can improve my technical coaching skills in these throwing events to help the expert. Also, if you mentioned in other corners of the internet about throwing strength and filling a throwing session with both strength and technical work, you'll see that in the free book. Is there anything I could add for the boys as they're waiting around? Farmer walks, wonderful. Overhead squats, if you can teach it. We typically have a group of 7 to 8 boys of varying strengths and ages than only one cage or shot put area. There's no reason you have to use the cage or the shot put area. Get balls and throw them against walls. Throw. In the, you'll see how I do it. We use sticks. We use tires. Throw. Okay? I hope that helps. Get the free book, danjohn.net, and then go from there. It's also at danjohnuniversity.com. Okay, we have a question from Paul. By the way, that was a good question, Ben. We have a question from Paul. I primarily do the powerlifts and kettlebell training, completed my RKC level one this past January. I've been interested in learning the Olympic lifts, but I'm wondering if it's worth the learning curve, being that I can use a kettlebell well. Well, Paul, I mean, if you want an Olympic lift, you got to learn the Olympic lifts. And I think if you want to be a real strength coach, you need to know the Olympic lifts. But if I'm not sure, you know, you're an RKC and you do power lifts, you know, you might know what you need to know. It will supplement both very well. Maybe you just need one of those weekend certs or US, whatever they're called, the Jim Schmitz ones. Or you could just, you know, hire an Olympic lifting coach, give him a few bucks to teach you. All right. I hope that helps. Short answer, because I didn't really get a ton of information, but I think it's important to learn the Olympic lifts. I don't have your age or anything or whether you want to compete, but for most people, I would recommend at some level knowing at least what they are and the basics of them. Okay. Thank you. We have a question from Tommy, and Tommy does that one thing I hate the most. So Tommy, and I think you're from England, probably. In your book, Never Let Go, you strongly recommend to have a breakfast every day. Now you promote intermittent fasting. Oh my God, you changed your mind about something. Oscar Wilde famously said, a sign of intelligence is to be able to hold opposing thoughts in your head at one time. Have you changed your mind, or does it depend on the specific goals? Well, yeah. So in the bulk of my career, Tommy, I worked with scholastic and collegiate athletes. And when you work with scholastic and collegiate athletes, high school and university athletes, generally practice is at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So there's an issue with training at 3 o'clock, and it is food related. I guess you could fast until after that, but that'd be a hell of a long fast. And that is what the Warrior Diet is. But when I was working with them, I began to see that their nutrition was terrible. The only real actual good meal they were eating a day was dinner, and that is if mom wasn't a macaroni and cheese maker. Because they would eat French fries at lunch. There's this place over here I go to eat sometimes, and it's next to an ice cream shop, and the kids eat French fries and ice cream. These are teenagers. It's just like I want to sit down with them and lean across and go, you are setting your body up for obesity, and you can stop it now in its tracks. But, you know, the destruction of their gut biomes for those kind of meals, and just the unbalance of carbs and fats and the salt and just the lack of what I would consider proper nutrition. And then breakfast, if they eat it. So my athletes, I had a girl pass out one time. I think she said 7. I asked her what she had eaten, and I want to say it was 7. She goes, I had 7 French fries. And I'm like, 7 servings? No, she had 7 French fries. That was her, from dinner last night until practice at 3 o'clock, all she had was 7 strips of French, 1, 2, individual French fries, which isn't a lot. And that's when I really started to push with those athletes, the importance of breakfast, lunch, and a snack, if possible, with many, I would encourage 2 snacks. But when I'm working with the typical adult, I really push, So performance, fasting would have value for performance. There's a value in fasting for performance. It would not be as you're preparing for the world championships. It would be a deep off season kind of thing to get yourself healthy. Cause one of the things, as you approach a long season, say 9 month, you know, prep year in a year, you're probably prep up for 9 months, maybe 8. And then, you know, an easing up and a starting up period, 2 months each. fasting would have value in there for your general health. You want to be, you know, you don't want to get the cold. You don't want to get the flus. You know, you want to have a structure of health. And I think fasting supports health. Most of the people I work with now are not scholastic and university athletes. Most people I now work are normal people, general population, and what I call everybody else. For that group, intermittent fasting has massive values. The quickest one off the top of my head is if you're not eating, you're not putting calories down your throat. And at some level, caloric restriction is helpful for almost every American I work with. The other thing about intermittent fasting that I like is when you do train, it blunts the hunger a little bit. And then what the window after you work out, you've just worked out, so you're probably not going to throw a lot of garbage down your trap. You know, you just trained. Well, let's go eat ice cream and French fries. Generally isn't what you do. I just trained and I ate fermented daikon, kimchi, oatmeal with a bunch of different seeds. I'm still hungry, so I'll eat a little bit after this. But yeah, you don't have to. They're not separate. It's just different times for different needs. Okay. Thank you. Okay. We have a question from Fraser. I'm 57 and I like to lift nearly every day before I go to work. For several years now, I've been tracking heart rate variability and resting heart rate every morning after reading one of Phil Maffetone's books, the Big Book of Endurance. It's a good book. I use it to determine when to take a rest day rather than take a rest day whenever a program says I should. That's interesting. So you're letting your body feedback tell you when to take a day off. One thing I've discovered, Fraser, is that if I plan my training well, that those things knit together perfectly. The same information is, the feedback from my body is the same feedback I get from the program. With a crappy program, that's not true. I'd love to know what you think of the strategy. I think it's brilliant, as I don't think it's used much in the kettlebell world like it is endurance. You know, thank you, Fraser. I like this. I'll just give you a quick example. This morning, I'm literally one day between road trips. This is the only day off I have this week. I flew home yesterday and I'll fly out tomorrow. So when I went into train today, I looked at my schedule for the flight and I saw that I can Olympic lift tomorrow. Well, my plan was to Olympic lift this morning. But when I got into the gym, I just kind of had that, yeah, the flight kicked in, and the flight, the hotels, the noisy hotels, they just kind of added up. So I just said, I'm going to do heavy hands and original strength, and which for me is a recovery day. I walk with the weights in my hands, and I do all the mobility from Tim Anderson. And as I sit here now, I'm like, yeah, that was a wise idea. So I wouldn't say you and I do the same exact. I always walk and do original strength on my recovery days because, you know, I'm a mammal and I like to move. But I understand your point. I agree with you. And I think it's good to have both programmed rest, like taking 6 weeks off, 4 weeks off a year, taking Sundays and Thursdays off. I like program rest, but I also like adaptability in. Now, if on the day that you're scheduled to have the heaviest workout of the year and you just don't feel like going, that's a conversation about a lot of other different instruments, but we can, it's the day of the Nationals. You just don't feel like throwing. Yeah. Then we'll talk about that. But, if you're doing this, I like it. I think there's real value to it. Okay. We got a question from Maciej. I always thought that Mass Made Simple Light would make a good long-term program with rotating exercise variations every few weeks. So it's a program where you do whole body workouts 3 days a week with an emphasis on one part of your body each workout, but you still do the movements of the other workouts, maybe one or two sets. Basically, it's kind of like easy strength, but with one body hypertrophy body part per workout. So push pulls me bodybuilding on today, and then squat, hinge loaded, carry light, light push pull, hard squat, hinge loaded carry, light push pull squat, hard hinge, hard loaded carry. There's your 3-day week. If somebody wants to do the program long term, would you still keep the deadlift out? Program calls for one set of 20 empty bars of tonic exercise after squat. The way I pointed out was the way I would do it. I'm sorry. You must be reading from the much, much, much older article from a long time ago. Low volume squat day. I try it the way I said it. Wednesday's your squat day. Friday be your deadlift and loaded carry day. Okay. We have a follow-up. Question number two, do you think the Zercher squat might be a good alternative to back squat for non-power lifters who train without a rack? Yeah, the only downside is you have to get yourself all the way down in that really deep position to pull it up off the ground. Yeah, Zerchers are fine. I still, you know, the way I teach the squat is six-point rock, goblet squat, overhead squat, front squat, back squat, Zercher squat. To be honest, most people don't ever get past the goblet squat. I teach the overhead squat, especially to people who are older, because it's become such a mobility move. Front squats, every athlete I have do them. Back squats, I use more as a tonic, as a refresher, and a mass builder. It would not be an in-season movement. And Zerchers are just another variation that we use. I would also include somewhere in that spectrum the double kettlebell front squat. I used to have the double kettlebell front squat with the Zercher because I thought they were so similar. But the Zercher, you know, the fact you're holding your elbows, it does change things. But it's a marvelous lift done correctly. And I think it, for a lot of people, it's the best thing they can do. For those people who've had who don't understand anaconda strength or have had some back issues. How an exercise holding the weight down here with the weights down here makes your lower back, helps your lower back is just a fascinating thing for me to look at, but it seems to be true. So and I'm not going to argue with the experience of other people I have great respect for. So thank you. Good questions. We have a question from Rob. My primary sport is running. And I supplement that with 3 days a week of ab wheel, a press, a deadlift, and a weighted carry. That's not bad. I also hang and do goblet squat holds. Okay, I like that. This has worked wonders for me. I couldn't tell you if I'm any faster than I was before or if my engine has improved, but my body feels great. I am certain I am more resilient than I was in the past. We're going to get his age in a second, but remember, the plateau is the new personal record. That's Pat Flynn's great line. I mean, if you run a 5K in 17 minutes at age 20, you know, at 17 minutes at age 50, that's pretty good. Okay, so let's keep going. I'm 6'4", 210. Wow, that's a long big runner. Sadly, not as some of those pounds are lean body mass. Okay. And I recently turned 38. Good. After the summer trail running season, I want to pivot towards primarily strength training for a good chunk of time. I think it behooves me to get strong, especially as I creep towards my 40s and beyond. And the research would support that. You want to stay as strong as you can, as long as you can. What type of program do you recommend for a guy in his late 30s who wants to approach strength training seriously for the first time in quite a while? Well, Rob, that's what the workout generator is for. I would like you to go to Dan John University and just start doing the workout generator. A little bit more higher reps than what you're doing. A little less easy strength is for a while. But just get yourself into prop. Just click, you know, just click and pick, you know, and then just follow the workouts 3 days a week, you know, 2-3 months maybe. I would continue to keep some garbage mileage in. You could probably... I mean, if you wanted to ruck, heavy hands, garbage, long distance running, swim, bicycle, just make sure the long distance, the time in the saddle is still there. You know, runners run, swimmers swim, bikers bike. That's true. But there is some long-term, there is some benefits of keeping, and I would say at least 1 day a week of long, And boy, I think that'd be fabulous if it did it like that, like a long bike ride on the first Sunday, a long swim on the second one, you know, I don't know, 13-mile hike on the third one. I just spitballing here, but I like that. And then as you start to transition back into running, give yourself a month. I would still continue to have the long bike, whatever, but then start adding an additional running day. So the long bike, the long walk, the long hike, and then a second additional running day a week, and then ease, you know, make a go to back to what you're doing in the weight room. And then, you know, you're gonna have to make a decision about what you can do in those long ones. And then you have to add a day or two of extra running. That's not bad. That's not bad at all. Okay. I hope that helped. And if you're confused, just hit the workout generator and it's like me holding your hand. Okay. If that's something you want to do. Wow. That was easy today. Well, there you go. Episode 145 of the DanJohnUniversity.com podcast. Reminder, if you have questions, email them to me at podcast@danjohnuniversity.com, and I'll do my best to answer each and every one. Some of the questions seem like, it seems at times I'm answering the same question all the time, but in today's podcast, you'll notice that they were all fairly new and fairly good questions, so I really appreciate our people this week. Podcast@danjohnuniversity.com. I'm here to help. And until next week, let's all keep on lifting and learning. Thank you.